Welcome to the CSLP Podcast, where we're helping to educate, inform, and assist financial professionals and student loan borrowers to make smarter repayment decisions.
Hi, y'all. Welcome to another and prolonged here, long absent of the CSLP Podcast. I'm here with Heather, and we're going to catch up on all things new student loans as the payments get set to resume here. Hey, Heather.
Hi, Jans. How's it going?
Oh, well, I'm as busy as I'll get out with trying to update clients and CSLP with all these changes that are occurring as people start to get serious about student loans again.
Yeah, there's a whole lot going on. I think we should catch up on where things stand because, as you know, here it's around the end of July. We're recording this, and it was less than a month ago that the United States Supreme Court shot down Biden's loan cancellation plan.
Right. So the $10,000 or $20,000 forgiveness is off the table. And of course, prior to that, we had the budget debate between Congress and the president, which passed the law or passed into law that said there would not be a continuation of this payment suspension. So we do know now that September 1st, we will start to have interest charged on loans. And we expect that payments will resume again starting in October of this year.
Yeah, that's right. So the debt ceiling deal means that the administration cannot further extend the payment pause that's been in effect since March of 2020. So that's too bad. But, you know, sort of last thing about the SCOTUS decision is that right after the Supreme Court said, oh, hey, President Biden, you can't cancel $10,000 of student loan debt using authority granted to you by the HEROES Act. And so, you know, forget about it. Well, the Biden administration immediately that same week instituted a rulemaking process in order to attempt to achieve some debt cancellation under a different theory using authority under the Higher Education Act. But that is going to take at least a year, probably a lot longer, because I would imagine there will be litigation around that as well. So debt cancellation is off the table, but also not, right? There is a plan B starting in effect, but we'll have to update folks with that later.
That's right. So they are looking at another option there, sort of to be determined. As you said, it's going to be a long, drawn out process and something that's not necessarily going to be right on the table here in the short term. That's not going to make things easier for payment starting, particularly, you know, the hope was or thought was with $10,000 or $20,000 of forgiveness that we were going to see a large majority of these low balance borrowers wiped off the books, which was going to make things a little easier for implementation starting payments for the servicers. But that's obviously not happening. So we're all heading into repayment here shortly. But you know, to smooth that transition, the administration did talk about some ways of making this a little easier for borrowers. They talked about their on-ramp, as they called it. And so, you know, they will have some opportunities to sort of help borrowers and servicers with this transition back into repayment.
Right, because canceling those balances of less than $10,000 would have reduced the number of student loan borrowers by about half. And so that was going to make it a lot easier for this to be more smooth, but it is not going to go that way. So the on-ramp is one of the responses by the administration. And what that essentially is, you know, just a direction to the loan servicing companies by the Department of Education that, like, hey, don't freak out if people don't make their payments. Like, don't report people to credit agencies for being late. Don't put loans into a delinquent status. And so that so-called on-ramp is going to be occurring over the course of the next year. So it will be around October 2024, when servicers get to start being as nasty as they want to be again.
Right. And let's also keep in mind that we're not just talking about the borrowers that were in repayment. We have new borrowers that have never entered repayment before, as they've had this 3 years of graduates that haven't even really figured out, you know, what repayment looks like or haven't had to deal with repaying of loans before. And then we have this other cohort of individuals who had maybe defaulted on their loans previous to the payment suspension, who under the Fresh Start Initiative are going to be back in good standing and sort of re-entering repayment as well.
Yes. And Fresh Start is, I'm glad that you brought that up, Chance, because that is really important for a large number of student loan borrowers. And the certified student loan professionals need to be aware that Fresh Start is a time-limited initiative by the administration. And so, you know, it's always important to check to see whether borrowers are in a default status and how to best advise them to cure that. And there's been no better time in history to do that than now because of the Fresh Start.
Right. I mean, previous to the Fresh Start, borrowers either had to consolidate to cure default, or they had to go through a long, drawn-out rehabilitation process. And now they're going to be able to sort of get directly back into repayment. But what this highlights is there are a lot of challenges for student loan borrowers to figure out where they stand with loan repayment, what's going on in the changing environment that's happened over this last 3 years, and really get prepared in what is a fairly short period of time to figure out what payments will look like for them again. And, you know, it's possible during this period of time, their loans may not be where they were last time they made a payment.
Well, you're absolutely right. So I think we know a couple of things for sure, which is that every student loan borrower should be advised to check to see who is their loan servicing company. Sometimes folks have more than one loan servicing company. And as Jance alluded to, there have been millions of transfers of servicers during the pandemic and in recent months. And so folks should log in at studentaid.gov in order to determine their loan servicing companies. And while they're there, they should also make sure that their contact information is up to date. So studentaid.gov is the U.S. Department of Education's website, and folks have a profile and communication preferences in there. And they should check those and make sure that they're getting email if that's what their notification settings are set to and that they're checking those accounts. But in addition to that, once they determine who their loan servicing company is, they should make sure they have login information established at the servicer's website and that the servicer has their updated contact information. So, you know, those are things that everybody needs to do. And then I think, Jance, you've been really getting at this and you've talked about the changing landscape of student loans. What that means is that borrowers are going to have to choose a repayment plan if they have not previously done so for their federal student loans. And even if they have previously chosen a repayment plan, people need to be reconsidering whether they're still in the right repayment plan, especially because one of the other new things that we want to talk about is that the administration is fast tracking implementation of its newest income-driven repayment plan, at least in part. And this newest plan is known as the Saving on a Valuable Education, or SAVE, SAVE plan.
They sure love those acronyms, don't they? They stick to them.
They do. My husband is a Marine, and the Marine Corps loves them some acronyms, but I feel like I've learned that, you know, it's really just a government thing in general. Like, acronyms are just big for government.
Right. Yeah. Well, so before we jump into the details in the SAVE program, which certainly borrowers should be looking at, you know, what their payments are and what they will be when payments start and assessing that. But one change before we jump in that, I do want to talk about a limited provision that's available for borrowers between now and the end of the year, which is the account adjustment. So we've had in the past, we've had that PSLF limited waiver that expired last October, but that waiver really didn't expire because it's sort of morphed and continued under this account adjustment. But there are opportunities for borrowers that may not be aware of what the account adjustment is doing to take advantage of that between now and when payments start, because that can provide a lot of value to student loan borrowers, particularly those pursuing public service loan forgiveness, those that may have had older federal family education loans, or those that may have loans from different periods of time that have different repayment history attached to them.
Yes, that's right. So this account adjustment is huge, and we need the CSLPs to be aware of the, and sometimes it's referred to as the one-time account adjustment, but it's essentially a plussing up of progress towards forgiveness for people both in public service and without public service. So the critical sort of time sensitive actions that we want to be advising folks about is that anybody who still has really old loans, now is the time to consolidate if they have not already, in order to make those older loans into direct loans. And so, you know, just to kind of like remind folks, I know they don't see them as often as we used to, but before the summer of 2010, there was a program known by the acronym FFEL, stands for Federal Family Education Loans. Those loans were not eligible for public service loan forgiveness. They were technically eligible for the long-term income-based forgiveness, but they weren't eligible for a lot of the best repayment options. So, and they also were not subject to the COVID pause. So there aren't as many of those FFEL loans out there, but there are some. So folks with older student loans or unusual loan types like Perkins or HEAL loans or some of the other health professions loans might want to consolidate. And the special sort of review of the history of those loans is only going to apply if those loans are consolidated before the end of this calendar year, 2023. So that's time sensitive.
Right. And it's not just borrowers that have these older FFEL loans. So for instance, I met with a client yesterday who had all direct loans, but she had had undergraduate direct loans that then she had spent 3 years in public service before she went back to get a master's degree, and now has had another subsequent 3 years of public service. And under this account adjustment, the new consolidation loan is inheriting the history of all of the loans that were paid off in that consolidation and that credit towards forgiveness. So in this example, she had a small amount of maybe $20,000 of undergraduate student loans that had about 6 years worth of credit towards public service loan forgiveness. Her graduate loans, which included a much larger amount, had only about 3 years of public service loan forgiveness credit. But by doing a consolidation under this account adjustment, the resulting consolidation would get credit for the most amount of payment history that it had. So essentially, her whole $150,000 of student debt would get 6 years of credit towards public service loan forgiveness when the majority of it maybe only had 3 years. So there are opportunities for borrowers and for CSLP to really examine the history of their clients and take advantage of this one-time sort of plussing up of credit towards forgiveness.
Yeah, and that's really a huge value that you were able to provide that client, and that folks can provide their clients, is by, you know, knowing that consolidating before the end of the year has a lot of advantages. You get the account adjustment and you get the consolidation loan plussed up to the highest number of months of credit towards cancellation, which is excellent. And there's also some help for parent plus borrowers under the account adjustment, right, Jens?
Right. So parent plus borrowers, particularly those that have some of their own loans directly issued to them, can consolidate those loans and they would get credit towards public service loan forgiveness for the most amount of loans possible or the most amount of credit possible. So there's a huge opportunity for parent borrowers here to consolidate their loans, not lose payment history as you traditionally would, especially prior to the payment suspension. Any consolidation would reset your credit towards forgiveness. And now parent borrowers and others can actually increase or get closer to total cancellation of their debt by doing consolidation.
Yes, indeed. So let me just put a bow on that by saying there's lots more detail about the account adjustment on the studentaid.gov site, and it is a good source of information both for advisors and borrowers so that you can benefit the most from that reality. And then finally, on that point, I feel like CSLP should be sort of warning their clients that the communication that they are likely to get from the loan servicers about these payment recounting procedures is that sometimes you're going to see your count towards forgiveness fluctuate over time. And it's going to fluctuate sometimes more than once before it finally settles where it needs to be. And that's mainly because the loan servicers do a sort of first pass at the records, and they plus up certain periods that they're able to scrub from the data. And then they have to transfer for a second review by the Department of Education. And then finally, that Department of Education transfers back to the loan servicing company to update their records. And so it can be, unfortunately, a lot of confusing communication that people get while this is happening. And it is going to take longer than the end of the year. So this week, in fact, the department started to send notifications to borrowers who have already hit 20 or 25 years. And so they're trying to, just as they did with the PSLF waiver, they're trying to process the adjustment for borrowers who have achieved all the time they need towards forgiveness already before we return to repayment, so that people who should have already had their loans canceled do, or at least are notified that they will, before they have to decide whether or not to make payments on those loans. But we're told it's going to be probably another year. And between me and you, I know we've discussed it's likely to be longer than that before the administration finishes this review.
Right. And along those payment count histories, you know, when people do that consolidation to plus up their PSLF counts, initially that consolidation, the new consolidation loan, will have no credited payments to them. So they may go from 48 and 60 on different loans to zero before those reviews happen. And it is taking time. You know, it's taking 60 to 90 days before we start to see those, if not longer, we start to see those appropriately applied.
And of course, the borrowers understandably get super stressed out about that. I think that the audience for our podcast right now, Jance, probably knows just as we do that it's really stressful for people to owe this money. And when, you know, you tell them like, oh, this is going to help you progress towards forgiveness, blah, 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 it really hurts them when they receive a notification from Mohila that says you have zero progress towards forgiveness. Or also they get one that says your application for forgiveness has been denied. And it's like, you know, it's meaningless because it's just, you know, form letters that go out and they can't seem to pull them back. But it's worth warning your clients about in advance, because then as an advisor, your client, you know, you're able to communicate to your client, hey, I know that this system does not work well and produces confusing and sometimes alarming information. And so I'm just telling you, my client, hey, you know, we're going to take these actions. It's going to be a long time before everything finishes shaking down, and we are going to receive confusing and inaccurate information in the interim. Because if you don't warn them about that, I guarantee you're going to be getting those calls, emails like, oh my God, I just got this and I'm freaking out, you know?
Right. Oh yeah. That's 100%. Because it is, you're right. It is extremely stressful for the people that have this debt and they're managing it. And what adds to that stress is the reliance upon these loan servicers, which we know historically have been quite miserable at communication and at servicing student loan borrowers. You know, one of the big concerns I have with payments starting is borrowers are unsure of what their payments are supposed to be. Some of them don't know where their loans are anymore. And as we enter into repayment, borrowers aren't sure what their payment's supposed to be when payments start. So they're not sure if the loan servicers are doing it right.
Exactly. And so, you know, I mean, I think that you and I, Jance, have spent, you know, tens of hours, hundreds of hours, maybe talking about how many ways the servicing companies have of messing things up and how significant and that is in the lives of student loan borrowers and their advisors. You know, I still think we should schedule ourselves another full, you know, period of time to talk about nothing but things servicers mess up, because that's always a hot topic that is full of high substance content. But let's talk about this, Jance. We're talking about payments restarting. We know interest is going to begin accruing in September. Payments are going to be beginning in October. We know the administration has instructed the servicers not to report people as late or delinquent. But as you mentioned, folks don't even know how much they're going to be required to pay, and they need to evaluate whether they are enrolled in the right repayment plan. And I think our advisors should be aware that the new repayment plan called SAVE is likely to be the most affordable option for the majority of borrowers for whom income-driven repayment makes sense. So this is going to be people who owe enough as compared to how much they earn that they would expect to get some forgiveness, whether it be long-term or public service loan forgiveness. And so what else do you want to say about the new repayment plan?
Well, you know, I think the new repayment plan has a lot of value to it. And I've been running a lot of scenarios for clients on it. And there are some scenarios where that payment plan is not beneficial for borrowers. And there are many scenarios where it is beneficial for borrowers. And so, you know, like the other plans that we've had in the past, it does take some careful analysis with your clients to determine what their expectations are and future payments would be. And particularly for these clients that are entering into repayment today or in the next couple of months, they may have a legacy payment on their current income-driven repayment plan that may be a lower payment than what they would have if they tried to change or enroll in this new save plan now. So for instance, a client or a borrower that graduated just before the payment suspension went in place may have a $0 a month payment that was suspended. And that payment is what their payment should be when payments resume. So borrowers that are on an income-driven repayment plan should have their suspended payment or payment that was calculated during the payment suspension become their payment when payments start. And for many of those individuals, it could have been 3 years since they documented that income, and their income could be significantly higher now. So those borrowers may not necessarily want to change to this new plan until their current low payment has run its course.
So let me just drill down on that with you a little bit, Jan. So we all know that any income-driven plan is going to set the payments primarily according to the person's income. So the income figure that the loan servicer uses matters a lot, right? And as Jance was saying, some people were able to document incomes 3 years ago that are lower or significantly lower than their current incomes. And so I think what you're saying, Jance, is that if they've already done a calculation using an income figure that is low, then some borrowers are going to be better off not offering information about their income until they are prompted to do so. And let me just reiterate, I've probably said this a million times, so the system requires updated income periodically, but it does not have any affirmative obligation for student loan borrowers to volunteer income updates when they are not prompted. So in a normal cycle, borrowers are prompted to update their income once a year on the anniversary of their entering the income-driven repayment plan. The COVID suspension has, you know, thrown that whole schedule out, and no one has been asked to recertify their income since March of 2020. But some borrowers have chosen to update their income, and I know this has frustrated you, Jance, in that you have some borrowers who are like, here's my income information showing that I'm, you know, whatever about my income, and then have had that sat on and not fully processed or fully entered into the system by the servicers because of the payment suspension. But I think the bottom line is that if you're somebody who makes less money now than you did the last time you certified your income, you might be best served by documenting that right away before you start making more. But if you're somebody who makes more money now than you did before the pandemic, it probably makes sense to wait until you are prompted to recertify your income. And at that time, you should also consider whether you should change into potentially this new income-driven plan called SAVE, because it might save you some money.
Right. And great pun, by the way. We also have borrowers who maybe were on the old revised pay-as-you-earn plan, which is morphing into the SAVE plan. And those borrowers may not be eligible for the income-based repayment 2014 or new income-based repayment plan, but may be eligible for the pay-as-you-earn plan. And they may have a limited opportunity to get into the pay-as-you-earn plan. And so the real point is borrowers need to know what their payment is going to be when payments start and assess whether or not that payment is appropriate for them and best for them, and be able to look at alternative options available to them, meaning the potentially new save plan or potentially pay as you earn or other plans, and determining if those plans are more beneficial to them based upon their current income versus whatever their previous payment was calculated off of, whether that be entering during the payment suspension or before the payment suspension even went into effect.
Right, right. And let me do just a really brief kind of review primer of income-driven repayment generally, and then just highlight a couple of the largest changes that are available with this new SAVE plan, and then we'll keep on, you know, sort of talking through strategy. So when I say income-driven repayment, I mean that to be an umbrella term that encompasses all the individual plans, which, as we know, are income contingent repayment, two kinds of income-based repayment, pay-as-you-earn, revised pay-as-you-earn, and now this new SAVE plan. And we can talk about the way that they're sunsetting things over time in a minute. But the gist of the income-driven plans is that they take some percentage of the federal poverty guidelines and they protect that some percentage of income from being subject to student loan payments. So under most of the previously existing plans, the percentage of federal poverty was 150%. So that was not true of income contingent repayment, but in general, the plans took 150% of the federal poverty rate and said, you don't have to pay any portion of this part of your income to your student loan payments. And under the SAVE plan, the big change that is being implemented immediately is that the amount of income protected will rise from 150% to 225% of the federal poverty guidelines. So the amount of income that's protected is larger, which means that the amount of income that is subject to payment is smaller. And so that's a huge change, and that is being implemented immediately. The other amazing portion, it's got to be my favorite thing about the new SAVE plan, is that the government is no longer going to charge monthly interest that is not covered by the borrower's payment. So if a student loan borrower pays what they owe under the SAVE plan, they won't see their balance grow due to unpaid interest. So, you know, like let's say you owe $100,000 at 6% interest. That means you're accruing $6,000 of interest a year or $500 a month. And a borrower in the past who made a payment of, you know, $300 because that was what was due and there was $500 of interest accruing, they would still owe that $200. Or if they were in the repay plan, they could get half of it waived and they would only owe $100 of that unpaid $200. But under the SAVE plan, there will no longer be monthly interest accruing that is not covered by the required payment. And I saw a thing where the Department of Education is estimating that like 70% of the people who were enrolled in income-driven plans before COVID had payments that were not covering the monthly interest. So that is a huge change.
Right. And you know, that's to be expected because those people that were covering the monthly interest on their payments were likely going to end up paying their loans off before they ever achieved forgiveness in many cases, right?
Yeah.
But that increase in protected income for a single individual, sort of the easiest way to think about it, equates to about an additional $11,000 a year protected income or nearly, you know, $100 a month in terms of a loan payment. So, you know, for a single person that just graduated, they can earn $11,000 more than they could have previously, you know, just over $30,000, $32,000 and not have a payment. Or if they were earning over that $32,000, $33,000 figure, their payments would be reduced by as much as $100 a month in this new SAVE plan. So that's very beneficial. The interest accrual is very beneficial. You know, the downside to that SAVE program is for our graduate borrowers that they're kind of pushed back into the 25-year repayment term on the maximum forgiveness versus some of the other plans that may allow for forgiveness after only 20 years. On the other side of that coin, though, you know, those that only went to undergrad and didn't borrow nearly as much debt have the opportunity to have their loans canceled as short as 10 years of making payments if they had smaller balances. So, you know, there's winners and losers with each program and each plan. And I think that's why it needs to be carefully analyzed. Certainly, payments that are being made under old plans can later be counted towards the new plan, the new save plan, if someone moves. So again, if somebody has a very low payment that was calculated on lower income 3 years ago, they're better off riding that payment out before they change. So they get low payments and credit, even if they lose some of that interest subsidy for a period of time. But this new plan is going to be very valuable to a lot of individuals. Those individuals that have incomes closer to their balances are going to be those that benefit less from that interest subsidy. So in the analysis that I've been running over the last couple of weeks on these programs, that save plan is less valuable to those graduate professionals who are expecting higher incomes that would have the additional 5 years of payments. And those additional 5 years of payments on higher incomes with a less value in the interest subsidy because they're making larger payments don't see as much value as those that have lower incomes compared to their debts.
Right. And, you know, that's sort of a continuation of what we've already seen in the past with these income-driven plans more generally is that, you know, the more disconnect there is between your income and your balance, the more you benefit from income-driven repayment and now in particular the SAVE plan, because the more you gain from these interest subsidies and the more potential you have to achieve some forgiveness. But I will say also, I think it's, you know, if because we're talking to such an elite audience of professionals who have thought about these things in some detail, I think it's important to note that, you know, a lot of the media coverage of the new repayment plan is saying things that are true that the administration has put forward about, like, oh, this is going to cut undergraduate borrowers' payments in half. Okay, yeah, but that part of it isn't being implemented until next year. So there are only some parts of the SAVE plan that are available now and other parts that will not take effect until July 1st, 2024. Most specifically, this whole cutting of payments on undergraduate loans. So as we mentioned, the big parts of SAVE that are being implemented now are the increase to the amount of protected income by increasing the amount from 150% of the federal poverty level to 225% of the federal poverty level. So the amount of protected income is increased, and also the interest accrual is reduced by that monthly subsidy to the extent that the payment does not fully cover the accruing interest. So those are the two primary benefits that are being fast-tracked and implemented now. Other benefits will not take effect until next year. People who only have undergraduate loans will pay a lower percentage of their discretionary income. So discretionary income under an income-driven plan is the amount above that percentage of poverty that someone earns. So under SAVE, it's the amount folks earn above 225% of poverty. People with exclusively graduate or professional debt will continue to pay 10% of that discretionary income. People with exclusively undergraduate debt will be reduced down to 5% of that discretionary income next July. And then there's going to be a whole elaborate calculation, which we will address in a later podcast, of using a weighted average between 5 and 10% for people who have loans from both kinds of school. And then, as Jance mentioned, folks with quite low original principal balances, so principal balances of $12,000 or less, will get forgiveness in just 10 years. And then there's going to be a whole sort of sliding scale of forgiveness up from there. Again, that doesn't take effect until next July. So there's going to be a lot more detail to this in terms of like, there's going to be like automatic enrollment in SAVE for people who are late on payments. There's stuff that applies to borrowers in default. And there's all kinds of things about deferments and credit for forbearances. We can address all that another time. I think the critical thing for the CSLP to know now before we enter repayment is that many people will have a lower payment under SAVE than they would under other plans, but that the timing of potentially choosing the SAVE plan is a function of their income documentation and whether their income has gone up or gone down, or when they are prompted to update their income.
Right. And let's be clear, as of the recording of this podcast, the Department of Education has not yet created or released their new income-driven repayment plan request form, which would include the SAVE plan. So the Department of Education is stating that borrowers who enroll or are enrolled in the revised pay-as-you-earn plan will be transitioned to the SAVE plan when payments resume, but it's not quite clear what exactly that means, because I can't imagine someone who was in the revised pay-as-you-earn plan with income documentation over 3 years ago at Fed Loans, whose loans have now moved to Mohela, are in any position where the Department of Education has the ability to recalculate their payment to a different amount now when payments start. I assume that they will likely still resume their underlying payment. And if they wanted to change, they would need to do a recalculation of payments under the repay plan. But again, I'm not sure if the servicers are even capable of making those changes unless the payment's recalculated after some future date. So I'm really leery of how exactly that's going to transpire with the transition of borrowers from repay to SAVE before payments start, which is 60 days away.
Yeah, it's going to be a giant mess. There's going to be so many ways in which this is a giant, giant mess. And it's super confusing to borrowers and advisors alike, too, that like, you know, the department is saying, oh, enroll in repay and we'll automatically switch you to SAVE. Okay, well, that's confusing anyway. And then they say that they're going to use the terms repay and SAVE, quote unquote, interchangeably. It's going to be super, super confusing.
For sure. And let's not leave out the cohort of borrowers that are entering repayment that are not on an income-driven repayment plan, that are not going to have a payment that is the same as what their payment was when payments were suspended, those being on graduated, extended, and fixed repayment plans. They're on schedules, payment schedules that are set to pay their loans off by a certain date. And assuming they did not make payments during the payment suspension, they have the same balance and a shorter period of time to which they have to pay those loans off by. And they're going to experience a recalculation of payments that are going to be quite a bit higher than it potentially was before the payment suspension started.
Well, and supposedly, though, the department is saying that they're going to exclude the period of the payment suspension from the maximum repayment term. So like if you had enrolled in a standard 10-year plan, so under a standard 10-year plan, the term is 10 years, right? So if you're paying the amount, it's supposed to be you make 120 payments and then the balance is zero at the end of that length of time. They're saying that the time where no interest accrued and no payments were required is going to be excluded from that 10 years. So that would essentially add it on so that, like, you know, because what Jance is saying would be a huge problem, right? If people were suddenly told, well, we're going to compress your payments into, you know, 7 years instead of 10, or, you know, the remainder of the 7 years, like that would be unfair. But they also, there is no, as far as I've ever noticed, there has been no consistency among the servicers in terms of when they or if they do re-amortize anything under those standard terms.
Right. It's going to be very confusing. And for borrowers that made payments during the COVID suspension, they could certainly have a lower payment when payments start if they're on one of those traditional repayment options.
Yes, right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, this stuff is just, you know, it continues to be mind-boggling. One more thing I did want to say about SAVE real quick is that not everything about it is good, right? I think Jantz nodded at that in terms of, you know, sunsetting the pay-as-you-earn plan. But another way is that they used to be, if you were a married borrower, you could file your taxes separately so that you could make payments based on your separate income, but you still got to count your spouse and your family size, even if you filed separately to exclude their income. Well, that's going away. So the Department of Education has realized that if borrowers are filing separately in order to exclude their spouse's income, that they're also going to exclude their spouse from their family size. So some borrowers have been used to a certain family size, and they may need to reduce it by one according to the new rules.
Right. And another change is, you know, under that old repay plan, spouse's income was always included in the payment calculation, and the payment was prorated based upon the proportion of debt that each spouse had. And with the new plan, if borrowers file their taxes separately, each borrower have their own income calculated to their own loans. And in the past, you might have had a borrower that had a small amount of student debt married to a spouse that had a large amount of student debt. And that borrower with the small balance might have had a low payment because they got the prorated portion. And if they're filing their taxes separately, they may no longer get that benefit. So they could actually see payments increase or see income-driven repayment plans that are no longer viable for them because of the change in treatment of spousal income and the allocation of payments between the two debts.
Yes, yes. So do you want to talk about the new public service loan forgiveness regulations, or is there more that you want to say about SAVE?
We could spend lots of time talking about SAVE and the new regulations for income-driven repayment plans, how they've changed. But I think from a very high level, we've covered what's most important for borrowers and for their advisors to know now. Of course, what else is coming down the pipeline, or what's now, you know, part of the landscape of student loans now, is these new PSL regulations. They were final regulations released in October last year, implemented July 1st of this year, although some of them are sort of being overruled at the moment by that account adjustment that we discussed earlier. But when that account adjustment ends, you know, the new PSLF regulations will take place. And in the case of some of those regulations, they are pertinent now.
Yes, that's right. So some of the highlights to these new regs that are implemented now is that no longer is there such a weirdly confusing standard of what qualifies as full-time. So in the past, there were two different ways of measuring full-time status. A borrower who worked for an employer who had a standard of full-time, and that standard was greater than 30 hours, had to meet their employer's standard of what counted as full-time. That was unworkable all along, so they've decided that it's flat 30 hours a week as measured on the period for which the employer is certifying on the PSLF form. So 30 hours a week, full stop, no more weirdness in terms of alternative definitions for what counts as full time.
Right. Yeah. So that makes it a much simpler process for employers and for those pursuing public service loan forgiveness. Previously, if they were under their single employer's full-time definition, they had to meet that at least 30-hour requirement with two employers. So some people were having to pick up, you know, a small part-time job to get the two employers to get them over the 30 hours. So this is going to streamline it and make it much easier for borrowers. Also, what's a huge change to these regulations are the treatment of some contracted employees who work for qualified organizations but are prohibited by state law from being direct employees are now going to get PSLF or can get PSLF credit.
Yeah, that, as you said, that's a huge change. So from the beginning of public service loan forgiveness, the regulations indicated in the application of the regulations reiterated that folks had to be employed directly. And at some point they introduced language about that, meaning that you were a quote unquote W-2 employee. But there was a lot of going around about it. And now the department has stated that folks that don't get W-2s but instead get 1099s because they are not full-time direct employees will be permitted to be considered in qualifying employment if their employer certifies them based on the employer's determination that state law prohibited them from being employed directly. So Jance and I sometimes refer to this in shorthand as the Texas and California doctors rule. And that's because those were the groups that were most vocal and persuasive in their advocacy to the department by saying that in those states, Texas and California, physicians were by law prohibited from being employed by the nonprofit hospitals in which they worked. And so doctors in Texas and California were treated differently than doctors in other states who were working in the same sort of nonprofit hospital systems. And so that is a new rule. It will be important, I think, for us as advocates and advisors to acknowledge to our clients and borrowers that, like, okay, yeah, the rule used to be different. So you may have been told repeatedly, your job doesn't qualify. You don't qualify. No PSLF for you. But that was true when it was said, and it is no longer true because now these folks should be counted in the universe of potentially qualifying borrowers. And, you know, a little bit of a weirdness to that is that we've heard in kind of unofficial ways from members of the department that the definition of qualifying employment, including the 1099 employees to which I just mentioned, that that would be considered retroactive in application, meaning that theoretically or not theoretically, actually an employer could sign a PSLF form for a borrower who was not a W-2 employee, but was instead a 1099 contractor and could do that for periods before the effective date of these new regs. So back as far as October 1st, 2007. Now, I've not actually determined that that is codified within the language of the regs themselves. So I feel slightly nervous about how that's going to play out, but that's what we're hearing.
Yeah. And I think the reason for that is twofold. One is that the Department of Education still wants that employment certification form to come from the qualifying organization. So let's say you're a physician, you work for a physician's group that's contracted with the hospital. Your physician's group, which is a for-profit organization, is not going to be the certifying employer for that. The certification still needs to come from that nonprofit hospital. And that's going to have the date of hire that you were working there or contracting there. It would be nearly impossible for the Department of Education with that information to determine if you were a direct employee of the hospital or if you were working for a physician's group or contracted from them. What I've seen in practice that's a challenge is, Heather, as you've mentioned, many of these physicians groups in California and Texas are not familiar with the change in law. So they're basically, or change in regs. So they're basically saying, or don't know that their employees could be eligible, but because the organization that has the employment record being the physicians group is not the organization that's certifying the employment certification form, there's a lot of confusion between the hospital and who actually is employing the individual to verify employment start and begin dates, because the hospital doesn't necessarily have that on record, right? Kaiser is contracting physicians who they hire the physicians, and Kaiser is supposed to sign for that individual's employment, and they don't know it because they're not direct employees there.
Right, exactly. And not only do they not know it, but it may not be easy to convince them that they can do it. And so, you know, like a borrower has to get a signature. Like they can't sign the forms themselves. And so we may need to provide some information and support to those hospitals that say, listen, you can and should start signing these forms when the doctors request it. And, you know, you're right, like they don't have the records, everything else. It's going to be a bit of a disaster. But you know, hopefully they'll be able to do something like say, okay, trust your physician when your physician says to you, these are the dates at which I've been positioned at your hospital. You know, that's, for example, one way you could do it, you know, because everybody's signing the form saying this is true. But I know that there's going to be HRs and hospitals that are like, yeah, I can't sign that for you because you're not our direct employee or whatever. And, you know, even if they read the fine print and then they're confused, they ask their general counsel. Anyway, it's going to be another point of advocacy for us to help borrowers.
Right. And there are some of these physicians groups that may contract with two or three hospitals. So the services are still being provided by the physician full time, but they're being provided in three different hospital settings, and not one hospital is, it may not be comfortable saying that they have a full-time relationship there. Maybe they're full-time and you may have to get 10 or 12 hours from each hospital to get you to your cumulative 30. I guess my point is it's a step in the right direction, but it definitely leads to some complication and some challenges for some of these physicians. And I've had some already that are struggling to get their employment certification completed because they don't, you know, the where they're asking to get this signed, they don't have employment records and they can't get it signed where their employment record is because that's not the .org address that Ed wants it to come from.
Right, right. Never a dull day in student loan world.
Well, so I think that just about wraps us up and gets us ready for the absolute disaster of payment starting that we anticipate it to be over the next 60 days.
That's absolutely true. And because we don't have a lot to do, we're going to overhaul the entire CSLP course because we have had so many changes. And, you know, we really haven't had any ability to do it earlier because these new final save regulations were just released. I guess it's maybe what, 3 weeks ago now we've had them. And they are what does this entire sea change for income-driven repayment in general and forgiveness in particular. And so Jance and I are going to go back to the drawing board and, you know, sort of start again to make sure that we've got, you know, everything locked down for folks. So stand by for not only future fabulous podcasts, but also a lot of new content for the CSLP course.
Right. Yeah. The CSLP course is going to be revamped and we hope and expect that to be released in the fall, giving us some time to go through the regs, make sure we have the right analysis, interpretation of everything, and of course, record the hours and hours and hours of content. So the new course will be available in the fall. Anyone that's going through the CSLP course now or already is a CSLP member will continue to have access to the most recent information through their membership site. So, you know, if you went through and became a CSLP 3 or 4 years ago, all of this new content will be available to you to reference in your practice and go through so that you're up to date on the most recent changes if you haven't been able to keep up.
Fantastic. Love it. Well, all right, Jance, before we tie it up, did you go see the new Barbie movie this weekend? It was just released.
Oh, I missed that one. I missed that one. We're not at the Barbie stage yet. We're looking for most of the small Disney films with my little guys.
Yeah, I know yours are pretty young, but you know, as a good, you know, card-carrying feminist, I enjoyed it tremendously because of course Barbie is a very complicated figure. You know, I mean she's both telling women and girls that you must be thin, which of course everything tells us that all the time, as well as that you can be anything you want to be, right? As long as it's, you know, thin. You can be astronaut Barbie, you can be, you know, chief sustainability officer Barbie, you can be President Barbie. Like literally, those are actually existing Barbies. Matador Barbie is a good one.
Right. You just have to be thin and have good balance because you're top heavy.
Yeah. As long as you're thin and you can stand on your toes, you can be anything thin that you want to be. All right. Well, good luck with your clients. Good luck, CSLP. We will come at you again soon from the Certified Student Loan Advisor Board of Standards, Jance Hoffman and Heather Jarvis.
Bye, guys.